From KALW News in San Francisco, this is Cross Currents. Context, culture, and connection from around the Bay Area.
I live in the Richmond District, San Francisco.
Ingleside, San Francisco.
I'm from West Portal.
East Oakland.
Coming up, we'll explore a whole new world.
Sony, Samsung, Google, Microsoft, the hardware companies are all competing right now. There is this arms race to get virtual reality in your living room first.
Then we'll hear from a journalist about her reporting on polyamorous relationships. That's couples who have more than one partner.
When I found out that he wanted me to write the story, my reaction was, I hope I don't have to go to a sex party.
And we'll meet a family preparing to raise their child with three parents.
We're kind of a modern family.
I'd say that, you know, whatever emerges, whatever type of person he becomes, he's going to be loved.
We've got a lot of love to go around today on Cross Currents. Stay with us. Virtual reality has been a science fiction staple for decades. It always seems to look the same. You strap on some headgear with a large, high-tech looking visor that lets you enter an alternate world. This idea has inspired novels like Neuromancer and Snow Crash, and films from the 1980s like Tron.
Kevin Flynn, computer genius, taken prisoner and held captive within the digital world of the computer itself.
To 2011's Source Code.
You are inside the Source Code.
What is the Source Code?
It's a computer program, Captain.
But attempts to make such a helmet that people use in their homes to actually get inside the source code have never become reality. Now, big tech companies think they've cracked the code. You can already use something like Google Cardboard to turn your Android phone into a low-tech, head-mounted view screen. Assuming virtual reality does catch on, what would a future look like where it's as commonplace as a personal computer? KALW's Jeremy Dalmas ventured inside the digital world to try to find an answer.
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy?
Dude, I feel like I'm living inside of a novel. Like, that is the story of humanity for the 21st century. I think VR is going to be huge. It's going to define life as we know it.
Chris Miranda is a believer. He believes in the promise of virtual reality. After decades of hype, 2015 may be the year that it breaks into homes around the country. And Miranda is one of the Bay Area-based programmers testing the edge of what these new devices are capable of. I was itching to know what a future might look like where humans were fully immersed inside of computer worlds. And I knew that Stanford University would have answers. Right now, I'm on campus in what looks like the quintessentially boring room. Carpeted gray floors, gray walls, and low ceilings.
So welcome to the Virtual Human Interaction Lab.
Shani Bauman manages the lab. Researchers here have been testing how people respond to VR since 2003. And today, I'm the guinea pig. First, she Velcros sensors to my ankles. They'll track me as I walk. For stereo sound, there are 24 speakers in the room. Bauman straps a small view screen onto my head. This is the main thing that will immerse me in virtual reality. I can't see anything except what's on the 3D screen. She tells me when I move my head, it will change the view of the virtual world to match.
Keep your head pointed forward for a moment.
So right now I just see gray.
Right there.
She boots up the program.
Oh, and I'm still in the room.
And suddenly, I'm transported. Except it's a digital copy of the room. It's weird. I feel like I'm still in the room. And I am still in the room. But I also know pretty much anything can happen now. And it does. Soon, the floor drops out. And I'm flying through outer space. There are giant colorful balls all around me.
Am I in, like, the Sweet Tart universe? Oh, and there's a little spaceship traveling.
Just for a moment. Now if you look below you...
It's cute. And soon, the room is shaking as I fly by the sun. Then, I slam back to Earth. I take off the helmet, and I'm back.
This is the weirdest part, to be back in the real world. My head hurts a little now. I'm not sure if it's because it was on too tight. Maybe it was because I'm just not used to virtual reality yet.
I did feel like I was in a different place. To be honest, though, it didn't seem that earth-shattering. But maybe that's the most remarkable thing about it, how naturally I slipped into the virtual world, I didn't second guess it. But I might have if I had come here a few years or even a few months ago.
We've just installed this head-mounted display about a month and a half ago.
The headset I just used is made by a company called Oculus.
The previous head-mounted display was very big. It weighed, you know, over 3 pounds, and it cost about $40,000. This machine here is in the hundreds of dollar range, and it's obviously much smaller. It's lighter. It's less than a pound.
VR is getting smaller, cheaper, better. And interest is exploding right now.
This is a spectacularly busy time. I've been studying virtual reality for 20 years now, and we've seen more change in the last 6 months than we have in the last 15 years combined.
Jeremy Bailenson founded this lab, and he's been a busy, busy man. Oculus funded its first prototype off Kickstarter in late 2012. When Facebook bought them in July 2014 for $2 billion, that was the tipping point.
Sony, Samsung, Google, Microsoft, and the hardware companies are all competing right now. There is this arms race to get virtual reality in your living room first.
But we've been here before.
Fly over Mars. Take a trek through a prehistoric jungle. Tour a house that has not yet been built. It's called virtual reality.
That news clip could have been the intro to this story, but it was actually from ABC's show Primetime in 1991. In the 90s, VR was in the news, on magazine covers, and there were countless films about it. From Strange Days...
Have you ever jacked in? Have you ever wire-tripped?
...to the 13th Floor.
A team of scientists have created a portal to a simulated universe.
Nintendo even made a game system called Virtual Boy in 1995.
The first three-dimensional stereo immersive 32-bit video game system ever.
That flopped and was forgotten. The technology wasn't there yet. But now, virtual reality enthusiasts are hoping for a near future where it's part of everyday life.
I do think it's going to have a major impact on the human condition in a way that, say, the printing press did have.
For Jeremy Bailenson, VR is a fundamental shift.
Psychologically, being perceptually immersed inside of a scene is very different from reading it or watching it on TV.
And he has dozens of published papers that show how effective it can be. In one experiment, they had people cut down a tree to see if that would impact their paper use. It did.
And they had to cut down this tree. When the tree fell, the tree crashed the floor and it bounced their legs. Really powerful experience. People that do this study, they call me months later and they say, Jeremy, every time I walk down this toilet paper aisle, I think about your experiment.
Experiments like that show how a virtual experience can influence behavior in the non-computer world. In another experiment, they brought in second graders, had them go to a virtual SeaWorld, and a week later...
50% of them had formed false memories, meaning they believed that they'd actually gone to SeaWorld and swam with whales. So for kids now, the technology is good enough to blur that distinction. You know, we like to say the brain has not yet evolved to differentiate a compelling perceptual virtual experience from an actual one.
How long will it be before the technology advances enough that adults can't remember whether an experience was in the virtual or non-virtual world? It's thrilling, but scary. Think of the plot of The Matrix. Humanity enslaved in a virtual world without knowing it.
The Matrix is a computer-generated dream world, built to keep us under control.
But Bailenson has more down-to-earth concerns.
What if online gambling feels like you're in Las Vegas? And what if every video game that you're playing, if you're killing people and you're feeling blood splattering on you and you're walking among the bodies? And I don't see virtual reality as a 10-hour-a-day type technology. My job is to create content that can be used for social good.
So what is that social good? I'm in a former movie theater in the middle of San Francisco's Mission District. The space is filled with virtual reality enthusiasts. 24 teams have 36 hours to cobble together programs to test the waters of what consumer-level VR can do. The obvious first thing is video games. But the most interesting possibilities are the everyday applications. Nancy Hall is one of the judges.
So what we want to see is we want to see healthcare applications.
for example. So one group here is developing a training program for how to put on protective clothing for healthcare workers fighting Ebola. Another group is making a game that helps patients with physical therapy. The Army, as a matter of fact, is already using VR to help soldiers with PTSD.
They're actually taking the soldiers virtually back into a war zone and then teaching them how to deal with that stress.
There are people here working on programs to do product design within VR, browse the web in VR. There is even a software engineer from the Monterey Bay Aquarium who is working on making a 3D version of the Monterey Bay for teaching and research.
We're going to keep building on it, and eventually we're going to get deep motion integration.
The most vocal VR evangelist here is Chris Miranda. Beyond being a programmer, he also hosts a more than weekly podcast called Enter VR.
Every single facet of human life that we know right now can be touched by VR, can be converged through VR. We talk about medicine, we talk about architecture, we're talking about education, tourism, sex, gaming, entertainment. I mean, every aspect of reality can be transported to virtual reality. And that, in that sense, yes, VR can make reality even better.
Miranda calls virtual reality the final platform.
It will change what it means to be a human, because eventually VR will live inside our brains and we will all transcend through this metaverse, this layer of information on top of what we already see.
Wow, yeah. That sounds like so different than right now.
Welcome to the future, sir.
Portable communicators were around in science fiction for decades before cell phones became commonplace. But so were flying cars, and I'm still hanging around BART stations. Right now, VR is all promise. The most common issue that people I talk to seem to have with it is that they want to spend more time away from video screens and computers, not go inside of them. But there's a certain itch about it that doesn't seem like it's going away. For Cross Currents, I'm Jeremy Dalmas.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hannah Baba. And now from virtual reality to very real relationships. Polyamory is a committed romantic relationship with more than one person. San Francisco Magazine's new issue features a story about the poly community. While many on the outside see them as swingers in disguise, the article's author, Julia Scott, says many polyamorous relationships are more cerebral than they are sexy. For the podcast Backstory, Julia Scott sat down with host Leah Rose to talk about reporting on polyamory.
So when you learned that you were going to be writing a story about polyamory, what were your immediate thoughts as a journalist?
Well, I actually pitched the story to John Steinberg, the executive editor of the magazine. He and I had a conversation about all of these quirky poly communities in the Bay Area that we'd been hearing of, but we didn't have direct exposure to. And it turned out that we both had very similar interests about the community, not necessarily to join the community, but we were very curious about how they make things work, not sex-wise, but love-wise, how those relationships could be functional on, you know, on a yearly basis or for, you know, over the course of a lifetime. And so when I found out that he wanted me to write the story, my reaction was, I hope I don't have to go to a sex party to write this story. and the way that he and I talked about putting the story together, it turned out that it was going to be more about relationships, to my relief, than about sex.
Okay.
And so that was nice.
Yeah. And it's funny because your story actually begins at something that's almost the opposite of a sex party. It starts at a support group for people who are in polyamorous relationships. And I'm wondering, while you were at that meeting, what did you actually learn about polyamory?
I learned that polyamory is an intensely complicated lifestyle, that there is a tremendous amount of support giving and support receiving that occurs. The kind of support meeting I attended is very common for relationship workshops here in the polyamory community. There's a lot of them, and that's because there's a huge need for leaning on your friends and local relationship coaches for expertise.
Did it seem like the main function of those support groups was people learning how to deal with jealousy surrounding their partners' partners?
Yes, jealousy is, my impression is jealousy is the top concern that people have. And when they see it in themselves, they treat it like a cancer. They're like, jealousy is unacceptable. Jealousy is a normal human emotion, but I refuse to let myself have it. So whenever jealousy comes up, I heard the same thing over and over again from people I interviewed. Whenever jealousy comes up, you're supposed to find out what's under it. And what poly people mean by that is you're supposed to go off and examine yourself and find out what it is about your own insecurities, your own upbringing, your own patterns since childhood that would have led you in this moment to be jealous of your partner.
Did it seem like people were actually breaking through that barrier and finding a way to not be jealous?
As you read in the story, there are a couple people who profess to be, jealousy gurus, you know, that they've kind of been able to circumvent or defeat the jealousy monster. But even those people, when I pressed them, were compelled to admit that they still suffer from jealousy from time to time. And the difference is that they're so good at identifying the feelings that are under jealousy that they can process much more quickly than somebody who might not know what those feelings mean and what they're doing.
It's very utopian.
It is very utopian. And I think poly, to the extent that monogamy is full of, you know, is very much a part of the tradition of sad love songs and broken hearts, I would say polyamory is the utopian kind of counterweight to that.
Today I'm talking to Julia Scott, who wrote the story Poly Love for the February issue of San Francisco Magazine. You write something about polyamory being much more cerebral than sexy.
You know, I think I was compelled to write that just by sheer virtue of the fact that I actually got my ear talked off about poly by poly practitioners, people who love nothing more than talking about poly in the abstract. And
right.
So people are very heady about
it's
poly.
It's very theoretical.
It's very theoretical. And when you can practice it, so much the better. Of course, that's when all the problems come in. But yes, sometimes poly doesn't actually involve having sex. And
okay.
this is a very interesting point that I myself did not realize. But sometimes being poly can just mean like sharing a mortgage with somebody or writing your best friend a love note. And it could be that person who you live with, who's your best friend and who you want to raise children with, isn't necessarily a sexual partner, but you do combine your finances and you may have had sex in the same room with them at some point, or you may have shared a partner at some point, but you're not necessarily having sex with each other. And so some poly people I interviewed did describe poly in very close to platonic terms for some people who they referred to as their partners.
What do you think polyamory says about human desire and our inability to remain satisfied sexually and emotionally with just one other person?
Well, speak for yourself. I think what polyamorists are trying to say is that it is our natural state to be sexual, to feel sexually attracted to multiple partners, and that monogamy compels us to pretend that that's not the case. And they're simply living a more honest version of sexuality than the rest of us. I'm reserving judgment on whether I agree with that or not, frankly, because I haven't tried out polyamory, so I haven't the faintest idea, you know, whether that's true. And so that's the best answer I can give, I think.
Were you at all interested in trying it after researching the article?
I can't say that I was, simply because it's enough stress on me to, like, wake up, pull my socks on, get in the shower, remember to, you know, brush my teeth in the morning. I can't imagine, you know, having to balance or having to admit several people to my life. It's just life is hectic enough without it.
That's Julia Scott talking about her article, Poly Love, in the latest edition of San Francisco Magazine. You can find it online today. She spoke with Leah Rose, host of the podcast Backstory. You're listening to Cross Currents. I'm Henat Baba. There are all different kinds of families, like the polyamorous couples we just heard about. But what about polyparenting? For as long as she could remember, Suzanne Thompson wanted to be a mom, but she was running out of time. She thought of her friend Christopher Nossel and his partner Benjamin Remington, who always wanted to be dads. And then she had an idea that could maybe give them all the chance to be parents together. As part of the StoryCorps project, the unconventional parents sat and made this tape for their son, Miles, while he was still in utero.
My name is Christopher Wayne Nossel, and I have with me Benjamin Remington, my significant other slash partner slash we don't have a great vocabulary word for it, and the co-parent of my forthcoming child, Suzanne. Susie.
And I'm Benjamin Remington. I'm sitting here with my partner, Chris Nossel, and my future co-parent, Suzanne Thompson, or Susie.
Hi, I'm Suzanne Thompson, or Susie, and I'm here with my baby daddy, Christopher Nossel, and his partner and co-parent, Ben Remington. This all started out as my crazy idea, I suppose. So I've always wanted to be a mom. It's something that I've known my whole life and always kind of imagined as being part of my life. The moment that I realized that it was time to put this plan into action, I was actually on a terrible internet date and starting to do the math in my head as he's talking about who knows what. of like, even if this were the guy, is there enough time to fall in love and get married and then have a kid? And realizing that, no, maybe I was out of time for that, and started to go through the process of actually looking through, you know, sperm donors. And it just struck me that you could choose hair color and eye color and how tall they were. But what I really cared about was, well, is this a good person? Are they smart? Are they funny? Are they, you know, the qualities that I would want to pass on to my child? And so I got the idea of asking Chris and asking him to either just donate sperm all the way through possibly actually co-parenting and kind of a range of different options, because Chris was really the only person that I could imagine attempting this with.
Well, as you might imagine, it felt sort of the most overwhelming compliment I think that a dude can get. And but thank you.
But yeah. You tried to say yes right away.
Did I really?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I told you, you have to think about it.
Well, I think for me, you know, I knew I wanted to have kids, and I knew that when I did, it was going to be under an unusual circumstance, you know, just by nature of the way that, you know, being a gay man works.
My dad and my mom were both had a ton of questions. Well, wait a minute. Well, who's going to have the kid? Well, what is going to happen around that? It was a litany of questions. They were all fine questions. And as soon as I was able to go, oh, well, it's like we are divorced parents, but without the acrimony. And like light bulbs go off and go, oh, okay. Mm-hmm. So we're kind of a modern family.
I'd say that, you know, whatever emerges, whatever type of person he becomes, he's going to be loved. I mean, by a lot of people.
If you have a modern family, we'd love to hear from you. Email us at news@kalw.org or find us on Facebook and Twitter at KALW or call us. 415-264-7106 is the number. That's 415-264-7106. Because of you, we can proudly say we're listener-supported public radio. Our team includes Leela Day, Audrey Dilling, Chris Hambrick, Chris Hoff, Ashley Ann Krigbaum, Liz Mack, Marlo McKenzie, Ted Muldoon, Colin Peden, and Stephen Short. Today's show was engineered by Seth Samuel. The line producer was Sandhya Dirks. Our managing editor is Jen Chien. Managing producer is Julie Kane. Ben Trefney is our news director. Our theme music is by the John Santos Quintet. And this music is by the San Francisco band The Low Rollers, who will be playing on Wednesday night at El Rio in San Francisco. And just so you know, Colin Peden, a member of this band, is also a current member of the Cross Currents Audio Academy. Other staff members from KALW may be there, so come see if you can figure out who's who. Music starts at 8 o'clock. For Cross Currents, I'm Hannah Baba.